criticism, English criticism we are concerned with. But English criticism comes very late in the day. It can be said to have started in the 16th century. But in Europe, for over 2,000 years, literature and criticism had been there, especially in Greece and Rome. It was known by Rome, not by Italy, in ancient times. So Greco-Roman. If we are looking for the background to English criticism, its heritage, then we shall have to go back to the Greco-Roman period of ancient times. The very first phase or period of literary criticism is known as Hellenic criticism, which was Greek essentially. So the fountainhead of English criticism can be traced back to the Hellenic period in ancient Greece, followed by another period called Hellenistic period, and further followed by the Greco-Roman period. So these three periods are important for the background to English literary criticism. In fact, not only literature and criticism, the civilizational and cultural development of England derives, all of these derive from the Greco-Roman sources. Because Greek as well as Roman civilizations were the most ancient in Europe. England and France, they are important in the modern period, not before that. In the older times, it is the Greece and Rome. So we shall begin with the Hellenic period of literary criticism, which is primarily Greek. So, I repeat, the fountainhead of English literary criticism can be traced back to the Hellenic period in ancient Greece, followed by the period called the Hellenistic, and then finally, in the ancient times, the Greco-Roman period. So today, we shall try to detail or go into detail the first phase, the Hellenic period of literary criticism. We'll do that. Athens was the capital city of Greece in ancient times, Athens. This was the center of criticism as well as literature, with Plato and then Aristotle teaching and propagating their views on literature and literary criticism. Whereas Plato theorized about what literature ought to be, Aristotle did theorize about what literature is. The former one, what literature ought to be, is called the normative view. Normative. N-O-R-M-A-T-I-V-E. The normative view of criticism, where you are looking for the ideal, what it should be like. And the latter one is called the descriptive. So these two, normative and descriptive modes of criticism, you find in ancient times in Plato and Aristotle. These two, in fact three, the first philosopher in Greece was Socrates. And Socrates, disciple, student, you may say in modern language, was Plato. And Plato's disciple was Aristotle. So these three put together constitute the ancient Greek philosophy. And it is the time of Plato and Aristotle, which we call Hellenic period in Greek literature and literary criticism. So we'll be dealing with the Hellenic period today, taking up Plato first and then Aristotle. If you remember, Plato wrote his Republic and Dialogues. These are two famous books by Plato. In the Republic, one of the remarks relevant for us he makes is that in his ideal Republic, the kind of state there ought to be, what kind of governance, who should be ruler, so on and so forth. That is what the Republic is. In a way, the first Western document on the state, the nature of the state, the governance of the state, both are covered in Plato's The Republic. And surprisingly, in that ideal Republic, Plato says the poets will have no place. They will be banished. Their entry will be banned into the Republic. Today it sounds very surprising. But then in those times, when the philosophy was ideal and idealistic, setting up an opposition between mind and heart. The thinking with Socrates, Plato, and even Aristotle, of course, modified it a good deal. With the first two, Socrates and Plato, the thinking was that mind stands for reason. Mind is rational. It thinks rationally, logically. But then, heart is full of feelings and emotions. And emotions are unruly, uncontrolled, and hence the problem. Therefore, it is necessary to put a check on feelings and emotions. And that has to be done by the mind. So it is this sort of thinking which goes into the writings of Socrates and then of Plato and finally of Aristotle. So these three ancient Greek thinkers very closely related to each other are not so closely related in their thought. There are vital differences between, say, Socrates and Plato, Plato and Aristotle. So we will go into what Plato has to say about poets, about literature. Because our concern is literature and literary criticism in particular. So Plato's remark, as I said, was that poets will have no place in his ideal republic. Primarily concerned with the social function of art and literature. He was not concerned with literature as such, literature for its own sake, or arts for that matter. It may be painting, music, literature, all the arts put together. He said, unless they have a service to render to society, they are of no use to us. If the poet is writing only to please himself, then we have no use for the poet in our republic. Whatever he writes must be of use to the people at large, to society. And unless it is functional to society, it serves society in one way or another, we have no place for poets. That's what Plato said. And why did he say that? He said that because, primarily concerned as he was with the social function of art and literature, the significance of these as instrument for informing the mind and molding the character of young citizens of the state. In course of his dialectic reasoning, bordering on sophistry, Plato shows how literature as a repository of truth is hollow. In his dialogues on art and literature, Plato lays emphasis on how they charm the reader's senses and enchant his soul, drawing out and invigorating the best and deepest in the reader. So that is Plato. Plato thinks that literature nourishes feelings and emotions, which then cloud the atmosphere of the mind, of the intellect. And therefore, clear thinking under the clouds will not be possible. Clear sun will come out only when it gets clear of the clouds. So emotions and feelings in Plato's thinking are associated with the clouds. And mind is like the sun. It thinks logically, it thinks clearly, and it thinks reasonably. Because reason is the guiding force of the mind. Whereas emotions go by, feelings and so on. Another objection that Plato had to literature and to arts in general, including painting, music, etc., that they are twice, and in some cases thrice, removed from the truth, from reality. For Plato, reality was ideas, abstractions. If there is a table, there is first an idea of the table, what a table ought to be, or what a chair ought to be. That is, as four legs and a seat and a back. So this is an idea. So idea put into practice, you have concrete form of the chair. Which means the concrete form is an imitation of the abstract form. So for Plato, the abstractions, the ideas are the reality, the truth. Whereas this practical world that we have, the physical world that we have, this is an imitation of the real one, the abstract one. Then comes the artist. It may be the poet or any other artist who imitate the life there is on earth, this physical life. So physical life itself is an imitation of the abstract ideas. And then what the artist is producing as a painting or a poem or a novel in fiction, he is imitating the physical world. So twice removed from reality. First removal is in the creation of the physical universe. Second removal is in the imitation of that physical world or universe. So it is on this line of thinking that Plato called literature and arts twice removed from reality. Hence, they are not authentic. They are not true. They are mere imitations. And imitations cannot be perfect, cannot be flawless. There has to be some flaw, some shortcoming here and there. And therefore, he underrates literature and arts and calls them twice removed from reality. So that is what Plato did. In his dialogues on art and literature, Plato lays emphasis on how they charm the reader's senses and enchant his soul, drawing out and invigorating the best and deepest in the reader. So on this line, following it, Plato discarded the poets. Those days you had the poets. He says, I have great regard for Homer. He was a great poet. But then he was a poet after all. And therefore his poetry cannot be taken as truth. It is an impression. It is an image, an image of an image. So literature, he thinks, by and large, is impressionistic. It is imitative. And imitation cannot be real, cannot be the truth. Therefore, it is a little removed. But as he says, twice removed from truth, from reality. So, this is the argument that Plato takes and uses it against poets, against poetry. Because poetry was the earliest form of literature. Fiction, you know, comes very late in the 16th, 17th century. In between, we had drama. Drama, of course, was there in ancient times also. Greek dramatists, Sophocles, Euripides, they were there in the time of Aristotle itself, and in fact before Aristotle, in Plato's time, in Socrates' time, there were the dramatists. But even drama, any form of literature, it may be poetry, it may be drama, it may be fiction, novel or short story. Plato would consider it twice removed from reality. Hence, the downgrading of literature, downgrading of arts as a whole. Because the test is the truth. But then comes Aristotle. Aristotle takes a different line, which we called descriptive. And what he does is, he doesn't go after the ideal, what poetry ought to be, or what drama ought to be. He goes after what it actually is. So he has before him the Greek dramatists and the Greek poets. And he writes that treatise, the very well-known treatise, the Poetics. In the Poetics, in the opening paragraphs, in the opening pages, he defines what poetry is, defines what drama is, and the difference between the two. Different types of poetry, different types of drama. In drama, for example, he says there is tragedy, there is comedy, and there is satire, burlesque. And whereas the tragedy deals with the fall of a man from the position of happiness to that of misery or unhappiness. Comedy, reverse. It ends in happiness. If tragedy ends in death or misery, comedy ends in joy and happiness. Satire is critical of what there is. And the norm is what ought to be. Since the ideal is not there, satire hits on the points wherever the satirist finds any aspect of life short of the ideal. So that shortage becomes the focus for the satirist. So we have all these types of poetry, drama, and then, last of all, fiction. In poetry, for example, you have a long poem, which is technically called epic. Our own Ramayana and Mahabharata, these are epics. Over 4 or 5 thousand years old. Similarly, the Greeks have their epics. Homer's two epics, Iliad and Odyssey, which have become metaphors thereafter. Iliad, it is the story about Ilium. And Odyssey, journey after the war is over, you are returning home. So the journey of Odyssey in modern English is called Ulysses. So the journey of Ulysses back home to Ithaca. So this is long poem. Similarly, there are short poems like lyrics. Lyric is the opposite of the epic. In the epic, the poet tells some long story and it becomes a long poem. Ramayana, Mahabharata, long stories. Both run into hundreds of pages. Imagine poetry running into hundreds of pages. Whereas the lyric is short. You have 10, 15, 20, maximum 25, 30 lines. So that is lyric. And lyric is more unified, whereas long poem, the epic is episodic. You have one episode followed by another, 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 and so on. There is a chain of episodes which put together would make a long story. In the lyric, there are no stories. It is just momentary feeling or sentiment. And that is pictured. So that is the difference between long and short stories. The epic and the lyric. Similarly, in drama, so on and so forth. We will continue the story after the break. Thank you. Thank you. Well, to resume the story we were talking about, this was the Hellenic period we discussed, where mainly we have Aristotle and Plato, and before them, of course, Socrates, writing about or talking about literature and arts in general. Thereafter comes or follows the Hellenistic period. And after that, the medieval ages. And after that, the Renaissance. And then the neoclassical. And then the modern. And the latest, the postmodern. So these are the different phases and different periods of literary history in Europe, English included. We are more concerned about the English literary criticism. But then we cannot, you see, make out full sense of it unless we know its background. After all, this is very recent. As I said, it begins in the 16th century. But then before 16th century, literature and literary criticism had had 2,000 years. And in those 2,000 years, the foundation for literature as well as literary criticism had been laid down. And it is that background to English literary criticism that we are trying to sketch out in outline today. We will go then into the details. But first, the sketch of it, the summary of it, the outline, and then into the details. So in this outline, the second phase that comes is the Hellenistic phase, where the story is further carried, the discussion is further carried, beginning with Socrates, then Plato, as I said, and then Aristotle. Aristotle writes a full text which has survived. The other writings have not survived. But fortunately, Aristotle's The Poetics, similarly his Politics, his books have survived. And Constantinople, those days, was the center of civilization. And that's where all of these writers, they were following the original, the ancient masters, Socrates, Plato, Aristotle. Now, in this Hellenistic period, you find some changes take place. The original ideal starts getting modified, as it always happens. And new directions start emerging. And then the emphasis starts shifting from one thing to another. So this kind of shift takes place from the Hellenic to the Hellenistic. As you go down the line in history, you find that the ideal gets more and more compromised. And there is a movement towards the real. not real in the abstraction, as these Greek thinkers had in mind, but real in the concrete form, what Plato called an imitation of reality. Now that imitation becomes reality for the subsequent writers. And during the medieval age, a new religion comes, say Christianity, which was not there earlier. Earlier, those religions are called pagan religions. The Greek, the Roman, the Indian, they were the pagan religions, where there were not one god, but many gods. It was only with Christianity and Islam that God became one. So the earlier religions before Christianity, they were called the pagan religions. That's why we count the years in history in this order. Before the death of Christ and after Christ. So now it is AD. Plato, Aristotle, they were in BC, before Christ. So before Christ was the ancient period. And after Christ, it becomes then medieval and modern period. So Aristotle gives you details about each of these items. It may be types of poetry. And then each type having the ingredients of its own kind. Like in epic, you have the subject, the story. Then you have characters, several, sometimes numerous. And then you have diction, language. And then you have style, the language written in a particular style. So these are different ingredients or different elements in any poetic composition, particularly in the long poem, epic. Because short poem, you will not have characters, you will not have a story, you will just have a moment. In a given moment, in a particular moment, morning, evening, or midday, how does one feel? Sitting alone in a closed room or walking out in nature or amidst the crowd, these are different situations. And in different situations, an individual feels differently. And then every individual feels all the more differently. So that is why you have stories, you have characters, and they put together, you have scenery, background, location, locale. So location of the story again becomes important for its own reasons. That is why the book like Homi Bhabha's Location of Culture, which means you cannot study culture in isolation, as an abstraction, as an absolute. It has to be related to place and time. That's when it becomes a concrete history. Otherwise, it is just an abstraction. So the particulars of persons and places, they are important also in literature. In fact, as you go down, as I said, in time, in history, they become more and more important. And we come to distrust abstractions. Because abstractions are, to us, not realities. They are not practical. We have not lived through those moments. So whatever is experienced, as Keats says, whatever is felt on the pulses, so that becomes reality. Whatever is felt earlier with Plato, Socrates, even Aristotle, these feelings and emotions are distrusted. Now we are trusting them. After the Romantics, who entirely relied upon their emotions and feelings, how you feel, that is the only truth for you. Not what you think, but what you feel. Because thinking may be just abstract. Thinking may be in the air. Thinking may be nowhere. But your living, your experience has a definite place and time and the experience that you go through. These are the concrete aspects of life. So they have become more important now, as they were not in the time of the ancient Greece. So that is the journey from the ideals to the practical, from the abstract to the concrete, and more reliance on the experience rather than the idea. Not philosophy as such, but the experience of life as such. It's a complete reversal. Reversal of the ancient into the modern. In between is the medieval. So we divide history in these three phases. The ancient, the medieval, and then the modern. Right from 5th century BC, or maybe 10th, because Homer is said to be alive in the 10th century, 8th to 10th. Nobody knows precisely or exactly when he lived and wrote. But roughly, between 8th century and 1000 BC, which makes 3000 years today. So Homer wrote in that period. And at that time, the thinking was that ideals first, abstractions first, and what we call concrete is only an imitation. And therefore, removed from reality. Now it is just the reversal. Now the reality for us is what we experience, what we go through, and not what we think. So not the ideal, but the real, in the physical sense, in the concrete sense. That has replaced the ideal. So the age of idealism is gone. that belongs to the past, ancient times. As you come to the medieval, there is a compromise. There is an in-between stage, in between the ideal and the practical. And from medieval to the modern, when you reach the present age, then it is complete reversal. The ideal is replaced by the practical, and ideal is distrusted. You don't trust it because you have not experienced it. Only what has been experienced, only what has been gone through, that alone is trusted and believed, and therefore acquires the title of reality and truth. So truth is not the ideal. Truth is what you really experience, what you go through. So that is how meanings change, emphases change in the history of mankind. And these very things modify civilizations, modify cultures. And what you have in arts, in literature, is the depiction of these very civilizations and cultures. So in a way, literature also imbibes history. It moves parallel. It follows. It moves along civilization. So arts and literature, after all, are a product of culture, product of civilization. From civilization comes culture, and from culture come arts, sciences also. So these differences we must make out and must understand them as they are. For example, you cannot confuse culture with civilization. Similarly, you cannot confuse, idea with experience. These are two sets of different, things. And they have to be understood as such. And thinking keeps changing. In fact, no two people or persons think alike. Even within the same family, no two persons will be similar or alike. They have their individualities. And literature acknowledges this. Your idealism does not. In idealism, the entire mankind is man, at best man-woman. So there are generalizations in those ideals. But now we distrust generalization. We believe the practical, the experience, the individual, and not the general and the ideal, but the particular and the practical. So general and ideal replaced by, practical. And by particular rather than general, and practical rather than ideal. That is the journey from the ancient to the modern. In between was the medieval, where there was the middle stage, 50-50. 50% idealism, 50% practical. But now 100% practical. Whatever is theoretical, whatever is idealistic, that is distrusted. So, Socrates, Plato, Aristotle, these Greek writers, they come in ancient times, the first phase of human history. And in that phase, they are trying to make sense of what we mean by arts. And what is the difference between one art and another art? And what are the different elements within the same art, within the same form? It may be epic or lyric. And as we were talking about, whereas the epic is a long story with several and numerous characters, several and numerous episodes you see on the television. You see epics going on. Mahabharata, for example, has been going on for years. And every week or every second day, you have an episode. So episode also is, in a sense, complete by itself. At the same time, it is a fragment of a whole. It is a part of a whole, which is the long story or long poem. Call it an epic. So every individual episode has its own completeness. At the same time, when it is fitted into the long story, then it becomes a part. It does not remain a whole. So the part and the whole, they have to be fitted into each other. Whole is larger, part is smaller. But then even the smaller one has its own completeness, has its own fullness. So that is how the story goes. We will go into details now. What Plato said, what Aristotle said, and what then the medieval, you see, writers, artists, critics, what did they think? You have Longinus, for example, writing during that period. And then come other ones. Cicero comes a little earlier. Cicero, Longinus. And then the Renaissance. Actually, as I said, the English literary criticism, as well as literature to an extent, begins with the Renaissance. And the first significant literary critic in English is Philip Sidney. So Philip Sidney, then followed by others, Dryden, for example, even Pope after Dryden. And then, of course, the Romantics, Wordsworth, Shelley, Keats, Coleridge. Coleridge was a philosopher in his own right. And it is he who wrote in detail the romantic theory of literature, a romantic theory of criticism. And after the romantics, you have the Victorians, like Matthew Arnold. He stands tallest among the Victorians. Later comes Pater also, art for art's sake.